Morning, Mr. Pavick. How are you?
Your Honor.
As counsel for appellant, would you like to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
3 minutes?
The court, please.
All
thank
right.
you.
Absolutely.
Yes.
You have it, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. As the court's indicated, I'm Ben Pavick, and may it please the court. I'm here on behalf of the Hampton Public Defender's Office, on behalf of Mr. Peters. This case, and I appreciate the fact that this case was awarded and that I'm given an opportunity to address the issue that was addressed in the trial court here on appeal, it presents an interesting issue and an interesting question whether, certainly the context is that the victim was the subject of 19 prior convictions where the appellant had in some form or fashion committed an offense against the victim. He went to jail for those 19 convictions, had an extended suspended sentence on each of them, but did some jail time, gets out. Then the victim is again the victim of text messages, phone calls, things that are unwanted, although they were not directly connected to Mr. Peters at the trial. Nonetheless, she's the victim of continued harassment and continued unwanted communication.
None of those are related to the two convictions that we have here.
Correct. They're not. Correct. And then on two occasions after the appellant is released from jail, she sees him, according to the testimony, following her on her way to her 7-Eleven in the morning to get her coffee, and then she goes to work. She testified that she felt scared and that he scares me. When she was asked, how do you feel? How did you feel when he was following you? I felt scared. He scares me. That's it. And so the issue is her saying, I'm scared, he scares me, while she was being followed, is that stalking? Does that mean that conduct and that activity by the appellant constitutes stalking? Because that's what was argued at trial, that's what the issue was at trial, and that's what the trial court had to make a decision on. And the Commonwealth's position at trial was it is, in fact, stalking. So it's for this court to decide, just saying, I'm scared, he scares me, does that constitute stalking? My position would be no, that she would have to be put in fear of death, bodily harm, or injury, or sexual assault. Scared could mean a lot of things. Scared could certainly mean scared of physical violence. It could mean a lot of things. It could mean a lot of things other than fear of bodily harm.
Well, the way you posing that, you seem to strip the "he scared me" statement from the entire context of what was going on, which certainly seems to me to help define what the purport of those words would be. I mean, obviously, if somebody to say, he scared me, would not make stalking. But when you put it into the history of we've got the 19 convictions before, they stop when he's in prison. As soon as he comes out, all this history starts again. It seems to me you've got to put him into that context and not say the only thing that we're to deal with is whether the words, he scared me, could possibly constitute a form of talking.
That's a good point. And I did not mean to strip the other aspects of it. Clearly, that testimony has to be in the context of the entire trial record. And I didn't mean to give this court, nor on brief, did I mean to give this court or the trial court an argument, the impression that don't consider all the other stuff. Certainly, that's correct. That testimony has to be made in the context of the entire set of events. Still, nonetheless, with that, yes, he had committed 19 prior convictions, 19 prior acts against her. She's getting these phone calls and text messages, although not proven directly from him, she's still getting them. My position would still be, even in that context, and even given the entire record, to simply say I'm scared does not mean, to the exclusion of any other rational hypothesis, I'm afraid of sexual assault, I'm afraid of bodily harm or injury. So my argument is based on the entire record. Yes, I didn't mean to give the court that impression. I do want to comment on the Commonwealth's position on their reply that the assignment of error does not address a ruling of the court. In my reply brief, I've given certain factors in response to that. I do think the trial court certainly did rule that only stalking was or was not proven. That the Commonwealth's position is that the assignment of error on appeal doesn't brief a ruling of the trial court. That the ruling of the, according to the Commonwealth on brief, the ruling of the trial court was that the trial court only ruled that the appellant made contact, just contact in and of itself. My position is that that's a waived position by the Commonwealth that was never raised at trial by the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office. It was not raised by the Commonwealth's Attorney's Office on petition. This court accepted the petition based on the assignment of error that is now before the court, and that to now, on at this stage of the appeal, make that issue, my position would be under Callaway that's waived. Beyond that, my position is that the assignment of error does adequately address what the ruling of the trial court was, and the ruling of the trial court was he stalked her. The trial court did not say he stalked her. The trial court said he initiated contact with the intent to continue the harassment and continue to in effect bother her. That's what the trial court's ruling was. All of the arguments revolved around whether or not stalking was committed. The Commonwealth attorney's sole argument at the trial court was he stalked her. Even assuming for the sake of argument that this court feels that the assignment of error, the brief, does not include case law which addresses whether contact in and of itself was the ruling of the trial court, certainly I think it's discretionary on this court to allow an amendment and allow the cases that I put in the reply brief to address whether or not contact was made. Assuming this court doesn't even allow that, this court certainly has the discretion. It's not mandated to dismiss the assignment of error. The court has the discretion to consider that point waived. I would think, given the entire trial record, given that everything revolved around whether or not stalking took place, I would hope that this court would, A, consider that the assignment of error does accurately reflect what the trial court ruled, and if not, consider it at a minimum waived. But unless this court has any other questions, I still have a few minutes in rebuttal. I can certainly respond to the Commonwealth.
Can I ask you just on the, you talked about the fear, fear that he would do what when he was following her that morning. I mean, the time of day, or really night, early morning when it was clearly still dark out, and she's driving to work very early. He must know her routine, that she leaves around 5:15 in the morning, and she drives a certain way, and she goes to Starbucks on the way to work. And she sees these lights behind her, and they follow her all the way, you know, into the Starbucks. And she says she can tell it is he. Why isn't that, seeing that following you, why isn't that enough, especially as Judge Bumgardner said, given the history, enough to put her in fear?
Certainly my answer has to be in the context of the entire trial record. It's clearly unpleasant. It's clearly not a comfortable situation for her to be in. To not avoid the question, I don't want to. I simply just, what does scared mean? Or scared of what? She said she was scared. Scared, I would keep getting phone calls from him. Scared, he would constantly follow me to work. I don't mean to diminish it. It's not a comfortable. She could not be in a comfortable situation. That's not a pleasant thing, given the fact of what he had done to her in the past. But scared of what? Scared. She could be scared of a lot of things, other than stalking, what the definition of stalking is. And the Commonwealth was required to prove what she was scared of and what might happen to her in her mind if he continued to follow her. I hope that answers the question. I'm not trying to. I keep falling back on scared of what, which is the Commonwealth's burden to prove. Scared means she's a victim of stalking. She didn't say she was scared of him assaulting her. She didn't say she was scared of him attacking her. Just that she was scared. Okay, thank you.
You have the remainder of your time as your rebuttal,
if needed. Thank you,
Honorable. Right. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald.
Good morning again. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. I guess to address first the issue before the Court, we've briefed no contact. My opposing counsel has briefed the stalking issue. Looking at the trial court's ruling, I think from that ruling, and we've both quoted it extensively in our pleadings, I'm not trying to be tricky here, but the court says that he contacted her in violation of these protective orders. That was the trial court's ruling, and it is the trial court's ruling that is here before the court on appeal. My office is certainly not bound by what was argued by the prosecutor in the brief and op, and this court has to affirm on any good faith basis apparent in the record. Further contact was addressed by the defendant at trial. He argued in his motion to strike at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's evidence and in his renewed motion to strike at the conclusion of all the evidence that driving behind someone on a road doesn't make contact. So I think the contact issue was presented below, and it is fairly encompassed by the trial court's opinion in this case. If we're talking about contact in violation of the protective order, here we certainly have intentional visual contact, which under the Supreme Court's precedent in Elliott and under this court's unpublished case in Wyant can be sufficient to violate a protective order. Again, we have the victim who is alone in the dark in the early morning hours being followed by the defendant for a period of miles, demonstrating that he is aware of her routine. He knows exactly where to find her when she's alone and vulnerable, and he makes eye contact with her at the stoplight in the first instance on February 23rd, and he makes eye contact with her when he drives through the gas station on March 9th. In both of these instances, that was deliberate contact that the trial court found was intended. The court found it was intended to harass her, but it's certainly intended to pierce that protective veil that's been enacted by the trial court. And the defendant's actions in this case were certainly contact. That was in violation of the protective order there. Further, as the court has noted, the Commonwealth wasn't required to prove stalking in order to obtain a conviction in this case. The Commonwealth is permitted to overprove its case. Talk about cases where we have possession of a firearm by a violent felon or those kind of things. We can put in 8 prior convictions just to make sure the jury knows that we have one. The Commonwealth may have overproven its case in this case. Certainly we have a victim who is scared. We say scared of what? Well, she's scared when she's alone in the dark being followed by a man who has essentially shot shrapnel at her house. The record talks about the gun pellets and the washers that were shot at her windowsills. The damage was $6,000. This is a dangerous man, and she's alone in the dark on her everyday routine. Scared of what? She's scared of him. She's scared that he's going to hurt her. And the trial court can certainly use its common sense, its practical experience, just like a jury could, to draw inferences from basic facts to ultimate facts. The victim in this case was certainly afraid that she would be harmed by the defendant, even though the Commonwealth was not required to prove that. I think the evidence in this case is certainly sufficient on that point when taken in context of these parties' prior interactions. I would be happy to address arguments from the court. I'd be happy to address questions from the court about either the stalking issue or about the no contact issue as it's presented on appeal. I feel like the defendant in his reply brief did brief the contact issue. He distinguished the cases, and the court can certainly rely on his argument there. But our position is that the conviction should be affirmed.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald. We appreciate your argument. Mr. Pavick, you have your rebuttal time.
Thank you. I
don't believe I'll need 4 minutes and 50 seconds unless the court has 4 minutes and 50 seconds worth of questions, which then the court's ruling was he did in fact initiate contact, which was in violation of the protective order, and that he did so with the intent to continue and reinitiate harassment. With the intent to continue and reinitiate harassment. The Commonwealth specifically told the court, our position is it's stalking. It's certainly reasonable that anybody representing Mr. Peters at the trial feels that only stalking needs to be defended against, that the Commonwealth never at any time said, well, we only have to prove contact. You don't need intent to prove contact. Contact can be nice. Contact can be calling her up and saying, I'm sorry what I've done for you all these years. I apologize. It can be something beneficial. Contact. That's it. No intent.
And even if it's just if stalking has to be proven, he's not just showing up at Starbucks. You know, they just happen to run into each other at Starbucks. He follows her at 5 o'clock in the morning when it's pitch black dark out. And he follows her into the Starbucks, and he makes sure they make eye contact. Otherwise, it's rather difficult for her to know that she's seen him without eye contact being made. At least that's her testimony. We have to take that probably in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I assume you
certainly
agree. So why isn't this proof of stalking as well?
Well, I don't think the testimony was he got out of the truck and followed on foot. Certainly driving and making eye contact.
Followed her into the parking lot, though.
Certainly driving in the parking lot and making eye contact in the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Yes, I don't believe it's sufficient to establish stalking, as I've indicated. My concern, based on the Commonwealth's argument in the reply brief, was whether the trial argument focused on only contact. Intent doesn't need to be proven for contact. My position at the trial, as was the Commonwealth attorney's position at the trial, was that more than contact needed to be established to prove their case. The Commonwealth's position on appeal now is that the trial court ruled that only contact was made by Mr. Peters, something more, which is a repudiation of the Commonwealth's argument at trial. So certainly I relied on the fact that the court, and when the court, trial court said he did it with the intent to harass and continue harassment, I certainly interpreted that to mean that the court felt stalking had been proven, that there was an intent element to harass. You don't need any intent to prove contact. You're simply having contact. So that's my concern, based on the Commonwealth's position that the assignment of error did not address a ruling of the court. My position is the assignment of error did address the ruling of the court, and that the court felt stalking was proven. I may disagree factually whether stalking was proven. It's for this court to decide whether or not Mr. Peters did in fact stalk her, but I relied on the fact that the trial court was making the ruling based on the arguments that the Commonwealth's attorney made, and the Commonwealth's attorney only argued stalking. Only stalking was proven. So I had no reason to say, well, just contact. And hopefully I'm making myself clear to the court. There was no forum, there was just no reason at that point for me to think the court was ruling anything other than what the court's ruling was anything other than what was responsive to the Commonwealth's argument, that it was stalking. Now on appeal, for the first time, the Commonwealth is saying, alleging, that the trial court meant only stalk, only contact.
Well, counsel, if you look back at the warrants that were taken out initially, I mean, wasn't that in violation of a protective order? Isn't that what it specifically stated? Wasn't that the cause?
He was charged with violating the protective order.
So ultimately, that was what was before the judge when he heard the Commonwealth's evidence and also your argument. Is that not correct?
So correct.
If, in fact, there was not a charge, although stalking can be contact, certainly, we might disagree about that, but this judge found that perhaps that's the case, but in this case, if you have violation of protective order and the judge finds that the protective order was violated, then any contact, whatever that contact, would be a violation. I guess you disagree to that?
I don't disagree with that legal point. That's correct. But at the trial,
answer Judge Chaffin's question, then your time will
certainly, Your Honor. At the trial, the Commonwealth only said to the trial court, he's only guilty of violating the protective order because he stalked her. And throughout the proceedings, the hearings, pretrial hearings, and the trial, the Commonwealth specifically said they need to prove more than contact, that in fact, contact, if it's only contact, he may be innocent, that they needed to prove only stalking as to why the protective order was violated. So when the trial court said he initiated contact with the intent to harass, that it's reasonable to assume the ruling is reflective of what the Commonwealth is arguing to the court as to how and why the protective order was being violated.
I understand your argument. Thank you.
Well, okay. And if the court feels that the assignment of error doesn't address the ruling, I think given the entire record, I would hope at a minimum this court would think that issue was waived and not dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pavitt. Mm-hmm. We will greet counsel, and then the next